I want to see the cave.
She stood up. Dr. Malone was running her hands through her hair and blinking hard to keep her tired eyes clear.
Well, I can't see why not. We might not have a cave tomorrow. Come along through.
She led Lyra into the other room. It was larger and crowded with Anbaric equipment.
This is it. Over there,
she said, pointing to a screen that was glowing an empty grey.
That's where the detector is, behind all that wiring. To see the shadows, you have to be linked up to some electrodes, like for measuring brainwaves.
I want to try it.
You won't see anything. Anyway, I'm tired. It's too complicated.
Oh, please, I know what I'm doing.
Do you now? I wish I did. No, for heaven's sake, this is an expensive, difficult scientific experiment. You can't come charging in here and expect to have a go as if it were a pinball machine. Where do you come from, anyway? Shouldn't you be at school? How did you find your way in here?
And she rubbed her eyes again, as if she was only just waking up. Lyra was trembling. Tell the truth, she thought.
I found my way in with this,
she said, and took out the alethiometer.
What in the world is that? A compass?
Lyra let her take it. Dr. Malone's eyes widened as she felt the weight.
Dear Lord, it's made of gold. Where on earth?
I think it does what your cave does. That's what I want to find out. If I can answer a question truly, something you know the answer to and I don't, can I try your cave then?
What? Are we into fortune telling now? What is this thing?
Please, just ask me a question.
Dr. Malone shrugged.
Oh, all right. Tell me what I was doing before I took up this business.
Eagerly, Lyra took the alethiometer from her and turned the winding wheel. She could feel her mind reaching for the right pictures even before the hands were pointing at them, and she sensed the longer needle twitching to respond. As it began to swing around the dial, her eyes followed it, watching, calculating, seeing down the long chains of meaning to the level where the truth lay. Then she blinked and sighed and came out of her temporary trance.
You used to be a nun. I wouldn't have guessed that. Nuns are supposed to stay in their convents forever, but you stopped believing in church things and they let you leave. This ain't like my world at all, not a bit.
Dr. Malone sat down in a chair by the computer, staring.
That's true, ain't it?
Yes. And you found out from that?
From my alethiometer. It works by dust, I think. I came all this way to find out more about dust, and it told me to come to you. So I reckon your dark matter must be the same thing. Now can I try your cave?
Dr. Malone shook her head, but not to say no, just out of helplessness. She spread her hands.
Very well. I think I'm dreaming. I might as well carry on.
She swung around in her chair and pressed several switches, bringing an electrical hum and the sound of a computer's cooling fan into the air. And at the sound of them, Lyra gave a little muffled gasp. It was because the sound in that room was the same sound she'd heard in that dreadful glittering chamber at Bolvanger, where the silver guillotine had nearly parted her and Pantalaimon. She felt him quiver in her pocket and gently squeezed him for reassurance. But Dr. Malone hadn't noticed. She was too busy adjusting switches and tapping the letters in another of those ivory trays. As she did, the screen changed colour and some small letters and figures appeared on it.
Now you sit down,
she said, and pulled out a chair for Lyra. Then she opened a jar and said,
I need to put some gel on your skin to help the electrical contact. It washes off easily. Hold still now.
Dr. Malone took 6 wires, each ending in a flat pad, and attached them to various places on Lyra's head. Lyra sat determinedly still, but she was breathing quickly and her heart was beating hard.
All right, you're all hooked up. The room's full of shadows. The universe is full of shadows, come to that. But this is the only way we can see them. When you make your mind empty and look at the screen. Off you go.
Lyra looked. The glass was dark and blank. She saw her own reflection dimly, but that was all. As an experiment, she pretended that she was reading the alethiometer and imagined herself asking, what does this woman know about dust? What questions is she asking? She mentally moved the alethiometer's hands around the dial, and as she did, the screen began to flicker. Astonished, she came out of her concentration and the flicker died. She didn't notice the ripple of excitement that made Dr. Malone sit up. She frowned and sat forward and began to concentrate again. This time the response came instantaneously. A stream of dancing lights, for all the world like the shimmering curtains of the aurora, blazed across the screen. They took up patterns that were held for a moment only to break apart and form again, in different shapes or different colours. They looped and swayed, they sprayed apart, they burst into showers of radiance that suddenly swerved this way or that, like a flock of birds changing direction in the sky. And as Lyra watched, she felt the same sense, as of trembling on the brink of understanding, that she remembered from the time when she was beginning to read the alethiometer. She asked another question. Is this dust? Is it the same thing making these patterns and moving the needle of the alethiometer? The answer came in more loops and swirls of light. She guessed it meant yes. Then another thought occurred to her, and she turned to speak to Dr. Malone and saw her open-mouthed, hand to her head.
What?
The screen faded. Dr. Malone blinked.
What is it?
Oh, you've just put on the best display I've ever seen, that's all. What were you doing? What were you thinking?
I was thinking you could get it clearer than this.
Clearer? That's the clearest it's ever been.
But what does it mean? Can you read it?
Well, you don't read it in the sense of reading a message. It doesn't work like that. What's happening is that the shadows are responding to the attention that you pay them. That's revolutionary enough. It's our consciousness that they respond to, you see?
No, what I mean is, those colours and shapes up there, they could do other things, those shadows. They could make any shapes you wanted. They could make pictures if you wanted them to. Look.
And she turned back and focused her mind again. But this time she pretended to herself that the screen was the alethiometer, with all 36 symbols laid out around the edge. She knew them so well now that her fingers automatically twisted in her lap as she moved the imaginary hands to point at the candle, for understanding, the alpha and omega, for language, and the ant, for diligence, and framed the question, what would these people have to do in order to understand the language of the shadows? The screen responded as quickly as thought itself. And out of the welter of lines and flashes, a series of pictures formed with perfect clarity. Compasses, alpha and omega again, lightning, angel. Each picture flashed up a different number of times, and then came a different three. Camel, garden, moon. Lyra saw their meanings clearly and unfocused her mind to explain. This time, when she turned around, she saw that Dr. Malone was sitting back in her chair, white-faced, clutching the edge of the table.
What it says, it's saying in my language, right? The language of pictures, like the alethiometer. But what it says is that it could use ordinary language too, words, if you fixed it up like that. You could fix this so it put words on the screen. But you'd need a lot of careful figuring with numbers. That was the compasses, see? And the lightning meant ambaric. I mean, electric power. More of that. And the angel, that's all about messages. There's things it wants to say, but when it went on to that second bit, it meant Asia, almost the farthest east, but not quite. I don't know what country that would be. China, maybe? And there's a way they have in that country of talking to dust. I mean shadows, same as you got here, and I got with pictures. Only their way uses sticks. I think it meant that picture on the door. I didn't understand it, really. I thought when I first saw it, there was something important about it, only I didn't know what. So there must be lots of ways of talking to shadows.
Dr. Malone was breathless.
The I Ching. Yes, it's Chinese. A form of divination, fortune-telling, really. And yes, they use sticks. It's only up there for decoration.
She said, as if to reassure Lyra that she didn't really believe in it.
You're telling me that when people consult the I Ching, they're getting in touch with shadow particles, with dark matter.
Yeah, there's lots of ways, like I said. I hadn't realised before. I thought there was only one.
Those pictures on the screen!
Lyra felt a flicker of a thought at the edge of her mind and turned to the screen. She'd hardly begun to formulate a question when more pictures flashed up, succeeding each other so quickly that Dr. Malone could hardly follow them. But Lyra knew what they were saying, and turned back to her.
It says that you're important too. It says you've got something important to do. I don't know what, but it wouldn't say that unless it was true. So you probably ought to get it using words so you can understand what it says.
Dr. Malone was silent. Then she said,
All right, Where do you come from?
Lyra twisted her mouth. She realized that Dr. Malone, who until now had acted out of exhaustion and despair, would never normally have shown her work to a strange child who turned up from nowhere, and that she was beginning to regret it. But Lyra had to tell the truth.
I come from another world. It's true. I came through to this one. I had to run away, because people in my world were chasing me, to kill me. And the alethiometer comes from the same place. The Master of Jordan College gave it me. In my Oxford, there's a Jordan College, but there ain't one here. I looked. And I found out how to read the alethiometer by myself. I got a way of making my mind go blank, and I just see what the pictures mean straight away. Just like you said about doubts and mysteries and that. So when I looked at the cave, I'd done the same thing. And it works just the same way. So my dust and your shadows are the same too. So...
Dr. Malone was fully awake now. Lyra picked up the alethiometer and folded its velvet cloth over it, like a mother protecting her child, before putting it back in her rucksack.
So anyway, you can make this screen so it could talk to you in words if you wanted. Then you could talk to the shadows, like I talked to the alethiometer. But what I want to know is, why do the people in my world hate it? Dust, I mean. Shadows. Dark matter. They want to destroy it. They think it's evil. But I think what they do is evil. I've seen them do it. So what is it? Shadows. Is it good or evil or what?
Dr. Malone rubbed her face and turned her cheeks red again.
Everything about this is embarrassing. Do you know how embarrassing it is to mention good and evil in a scientific laboratory? Have you any idea? One of the reasons I became a scientist was not to have to think about that kind of thing.
You got to think about it. You can't investigate shadows, dust, whatever it is, without thinking about that kind of thing, good and evil and such. And it said you got to, remember? You can't refuse. When are they going to close this place down?
The funding committee decides at the end of the week. Why?
Because you got tonight, then. You could fix this engine thing to put words on the screen instead of pictures like I made. You could do that easy. Then you could show them, and they'd have to give you the money to carry on. And you could find out all about dust or shadows and tell me. You see?
She went on a little haughtily, like a duchess describing an unsatisfactory housemaid.
The alethiometer won't exactly tell me what I need to know, but you could find out for me. Else I could probably do that ching thing with the sticks. But pictures are easier to work. I think so anyway. I'm going to take this off now,
she added, and pulled at the electrodes on her head. Dr. Malone gave her a tissue to wipe off the gel and folded up the wires.
So, you're going. Well, you've given me a strange hour. That's no mistake.
Are you going to make it do words?
Lyra said, gathering up her rucksack.
It's about as much use as completing the funding application, I dare say. No, listen. I want you to come back tomorrow. Can you do that? About the same time? I want you to show someone else.
Lyra narrowed her eyes. Was this a trap?
Well, all right. But remember, there's things I need to know.
Yes, of course. You will come?
Yes. If I say I will, I will. I could help you, I expect.
And she left. The porter at the desk looked up briefly and then went back to his paper.
The Nuniatak Dig,
said the archaeologist, swinging his chair around.
You're the second person in a month to ask me about that.
Who was the other one?
Said Will, on his guard at once.
I think he was a journalist. I'm not sure.
Why did he want to know about it?
In connection with one of the men who disappeared on that trip. It was the height of the Cold War when the expedition vanished. Star Wars. You're probably too young to remember that. The Americans and the Russians were building enormous radar installations all across the Arctic. Anyway, what can I do for you?
Well, I was just trying to find out about that expedition, really. For a school project about prehistoric people. And I read about this expedition that disappeared and I got curious.
Well, you're not the only one, as you see. There was a big to-do about it at the time. I looked it all up for the journalist. It was a preliminary survey, not a proper dig. You can't do a dig till you know whether it's worth spending time on it. So this group went out to look at a number of sites and make a report. Half a dozen blokes altogether. Sometimes, on an expedition like this, you combine forces with people from another discipline. You know, geologists or whatever, to split the cost. They look at their stuff and we look at ours. In this case, there was a physicist on the team. I think he was looking at high-level atmospheric particles, the aurora. You know, the northern lights. He had balloons with radio transmitters, apparently. And there was another man with them, an ex-marine, a sort of professional explorer. They were going up into some fairly wild territory, and polar bears are always a danger in the Arctic. Archaeologists can deal with some things, but we're not trained to shoot. And someone who can do that, and navigate, and make camp, and do all the sort of survival stuff is very useful. But then they all vanished. They kept in radio contact with a local survey station, but one day the signal didn't come, and nothing more was heard. There had been a blizzard, but that was nothing unusual. The search expedition found their last camp more or less intact, though the bears had eaten their stores. But there was no sign of the people whatsoever. And that's all I can tell you, I'm afraid.
Yes, thank you. That journalist...
He went on, stopping at the door.
You said he was interested in one of the men. Which one was it?
The explorer type. A man called Parry.
What did he look like? The journalist, I mean.
What do you want to know that for?
Because...
Will couldn't think of a plausible reason. He shouldn't have asked.
No reason. I just wondered.
As far as I can remember, he was a big blonde man. Very pale hair.
Right. Thanks.
Will said, and turned to go. The man watched him leave the room, saying nothing, frowning a little. Will saw him reach for the phone, and left the building quickly. He found he was shaking. The journalist, so-called, was one of the men who'd come to his house. A tall man with such fair hair that he seemed to have no eyebrows or eyelashes. He wasn't the one Will had knocked down the stairs. He was the one who'd appeared at the door of the living room as Will ran down and jumped over the body. But he wasn't a journalist. There was a large museum nearby. Will went in, holding his clipboard as if he were working, and sat down in a gallery hung with paintings. He was trembling hard and feeling sick because pressing at him was the knowledge that he'd killed someone, that he was a murderer. He'd kept it at bay till now, but it was closing in. He'd taken away the man's life. He sat still for half an hour, and it was one of the worst half hours he'd ever spent. People came and went, looking at the paintings, talking in quiet voices, ignoring him. A gallery attendant stood in the doorway for a few minutes, hands behind his back, and then slowly moved away. And Will wrestled with the horror of what he'd done, and didn't move a muscle. Gradually he grew calmer. He'd been defending his mother. They were frightening her. Given the state she was in, they were persecuting her. He had a right to defend his home. His father would have wanted him to do that. He did it because it was the good thing to do. He did it to stop them from stealing the green leather case. He did it so he could find his father. And didn't he have a right to do that? All his childish games came back to him, with himself and his father rescuing each other from avalanches or fighting pirates. Well, now it was real. "I'll find you," he said in his mind. "Just help me and I'll find you, and we'll look after Mum, and everything'll be all right." And after all, he had somewhere to hide now, somewhere so safe no one would ever find him. And the papers from the case, which he still hadn't had time to read, were safe too, under the mattress in Chitagatse. Finally he noticed people moving more purposefully and all in the same direction. They were leaving because the attendant was telling them that the museum would close in 10 minutes. Will gathered himself and left. He found his way to the high street where the lawyer's office was and wondered about going to see him, despite what he'd said earlier. The man had sounded friendly enough. But as he made up his mind to cross the street and go in, he stopped suddenly. The tall man with the pale eyebrows was getting out of a car. Will turned aside at once, casually, and looked in the window of the jeweller's shop beside him. He saw the man's reflection look around, settle the knot of his tie, and go into the lawyer's office. As soon as he'd gone in, Will moved away, his heart thudding again. There wasn't anywhere safe. He drifted towards the university library and waited for Lyra. Chapter 5 Airmail Paper.
Will!
She spoke quietly, but he was startled all the same. She was sitting on the bench beside him, and he hadn't even noticed.
Where did you come from?
I found my scholar. She's called Dr. Malone. And she's got an engine that can see dust. And she's going to make it talk.
I didn't see you coming.
You weren't looking. You must have been thinking about something else. It's a good thing I found you. Look, it's easy to fool people. Watch.
Two police officers were strolling toward them, a man and a woman on the beat, in their white summer shirt sleeves, with their radios and their batons and their suspicious eyes. Before they reached the bench, Lyra was on her feet and speaking to them.
Please, could you tell me where the museum is? Me and my brother were supposed to meet our parents there and we got lost.
The policeman looked at Will, and Will, containing his anger, shrugged as if to say, "She's right, we're lost, isn't it silly?" The man smiled. The woman said,
"Which museum? The Ashmolean?"
"Yeah, that one,"
said Lyra, and pretended to listen carefully as the woman gave her instructions. Will got up and said,
"Thanks,"
and he and Lyra moved away together. They didn't look back, but the police had already lost interest.
"See? If they were looking for you, I put them off, because they won't be looking for someone with a sister. I'd better stay with you from now on,"
she went on scoldingly once they'd gone around the corner.
"You ain't safe on your own."
He said nothing. His heart was thumping with rage. They walked along towards a round building with a great leaden dome, set in a square bounded by honey-coloured stone college buildings and a church and wide-crowned trees above high garden walls. The afternoon sun drew the warmest tones out of it all, and the air felt rich with it, almost the colour itself of heavy golden wine. All the leaves were still, and in this little square even the traffic noise was hushed. She finally became aware of Will's feelings and said,
"What's the matter?"
"If you speak to people, you just attract their attention. You should just keep quiet and still, and they overlook you. I've been doing it all my life. I know how to do it. Your way, you make yourself visible. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't play at it. You're not being serious."
"You think so? You think I don't know about lying and that? I'm the best liar there ever was. But I ain't lying to you, and I never will, I swear it. You're in danger, and if I hadn't done that just then, you'd have been caught. Didn't you see him looking at you? 'Cause they were. You ain't careful enough. If you want my opinion, it's you that ain't serious."
"If I'm not serious, what am I doing hanging about waiting for you when I could be miles away? Or hiding out of sight, safe in that other city? I've got my own things to do, but I'm hanging about here so I can help you. Don't tell me I'm not serious."
"You had to come through,"
she said, furious. No one should speak to her like this. She was an aristocrat. She was Lyra.
"You had to, else you'd never find out anything about your father. You've done it for yourself, not for me."
They were quarrelling passionately but in subdued voices because of the quiet in the square and the people who were wandering past nearby. When she said this, though, Will stopped altogether. He had to lean against the college wall beside him. The colour had left his face.
"What do you know about my father?"
"I don't know anything. All I know is you're looking for him. That's all I asked about."
"Asked who?"
"The alethiometer, of course."
It took a moment for him to remember what she meant. And then he looked so angry and suspicious that she took it out of her rucksack and said,
"All right, I'll show you."
And she sat down on the stone curb around the grass in the middle of the square and bent her head over the golden instrument and began to turn the hands, her fingers moving almost too quickly to see, and then pausing for several seconds while the slender needle whipped around the dial, flicking to a stop here and there, and then turning the hands to new positions just as quickly. Will looked around carefully, but there was no one near to see. A group of tourists looked up at the domed building. An ice cream vendor wheeled his cart along the pavement, but their attention was elsewhere. Lyra blinked and sighed as if she were waking after a sleep.
"Your mother's ill, but she's safe. There's this lady looking after her. And you took some letters and ran away. And there was a man, I think he was a thief, and you killed him. And you're looking for your father, and..."
"All right, shut up. That's enough. You've got no right to look into my life like that. Don't ever do that again. That's just spying."
"I know when to stop asking. See, the alethiometer's like a person, almost. I sort of know when it's going to be cross, or when there's things it doesn't want me to know. I kind of feel it. But when you come out of nowhere yesterday, I had to ask it who you were, or I might not have been safe. I had to. And it said you was a murderer. And I thought, good, that's all right. He's someone I can trust. But I didn't ask more than that till just now. And if you don't want me to ask any more, I promise I won't. This ain't like a private peep show. If I'd done nothing but spy on people, it'd stop working. I know that as well as I know my own Oxford."
"You could have asked me instead of that thing. Did it say whether my father was alive or dead?"
"No, because I didn't ask.
They were both sitting by this time. Will put his head in his hands with weariness.
Well, I suppose we'll have to trust each other.
That's all right. I trust you.
Will nodded grimly. He was so tired and there was not the slightest possibility of sleep in this world. Lyra wasn't usually so perceptive, but something in his manner made her think. He's afraid, but he's mastering his fear, like Yorick Birnison said we had to do, like I did by the fish house at the frozen lake.
And Will, I won't give you away. Not to anyone, I promise.
Good.
I'd done that before. I betrayed someone, and it was the worst thing I ever did. I thought I was saving his life, actually, only I was taking him right to the most dangerous place there could be. I hated myself for that, for being so stupid. So I'll try very hard not to be careless or forget and betray you.
He said nothing. He rubbed his eyes and blinked hard to try and wake himself up.
We can't go back through the window till much later. We shouldn't have come through in daylight anyway. We can't risk anyone seeing. And now we've got to hang around for hours.
I'm hungry.
I know. We can go to the cinema.
The what?
I'll show you. We can get some food there too.
There was a cinema near the city centre, 10 minutes walk away. Will paid for both of them to get in and bought hot dogs and popcorn and Coke, and they carried the food inside and sat down just as the film was beginning. Lyra was entranced. She had seen projected photograms, but nothing in her world had prepared her for the cinema. She wolfed down the hot dog and the popcorn, gulped the Coca-Cola, and gasped and laughed with delight at the characters on the screen. Luckily, it was a noisy audience full of children, and her excitement wasn't conspicuous. Will closed his eyes at once and went to sleep. He woke when he heard the clatter of seats as people moved out, and blinked in the light. His watch showed 8:15. Lyra came away reluctantly.
That's the best thing I ever saw in my whole life. I don't know why they never invented this in my world. We got some things better than you, but this was better than anything we got.
Will couldn't even remember what the film had been. It was still light outside and the streets were busy.
Do you want to see another one?
Yeah.
So they went to the next cinema, a few hundred yards away around the corner, and did it again. Lyra settled down with her feet on the seat, hugging her knees, and Will let his mind go blank. When they came out this time, it was nearly 11 o'clock. Much better. Lyra was hungry again, so they bought hamburgers from a cart and ate them as they walked along. Something else new to her.
We always sit down to eat. I've never seen people just walking along eating before. There's so many ways this place is different. The traffic, for one. I don't like it. I like the cinema, though, and hamburgers. I like them a lot. And that scholar, Dr. Malone, she's going to make that engine use words. I just know she is. I'll go back there tomorrow and see how she's getting on. I bet I could help her. I could probably get the scholars to give her the money she wants, too. You know how my father did it, Lord Asriel. He played a trick on them.
As they walked up the Banbury Road, she told him about the night she hid in the wardrobe and watched Lord Asriel show the Jordan scholars the severed head of Stanislaus Grumman in the vacuum flask. And since Will was such a good audience, she went on and told him the rest of her story, from the time she escaped from Mrs. Coulter's flat to the horrible moment when she realized she'd led Roger to his death on the icy cliffs of Svalbard. Will listened without comment, but attentively, with sympathy. Her account of a voyage in a balloon, of armored bears and witches, of a vengeful arm of the church, seemed all of a piece with his own fantastic dream of a beautiful city on the sea, empty and silent and safe. It couldn't be true. It was as simple as that. But eventually they reached the ring road and the hornbeam trees. There was very little traffic now, a car every minute or so, no more than that. And there was the window. Will felt himself smiling. It was going to be all right.
Wait till there's no cars coming. I'm going through now.
And a moment later he was on the grass under the palm trees, and a second or two afterwards Lyra followed. They felt as if they were home again. The wide, warm night, and the scent of flowers and the sea, and the silence, bathed them like soothing water. Lyra stretched and yawned, and Will felt a great weight lift off his shoulders. He had been carrying it all day, and he hadn't noticed how it had nearly pressed him into the ground. But now he felt light and free and at peace. And then Lyra gripped his arm. In the same second, he heard what had made her do it. Somewhere in the little streets beyond the cafe, something was screaming. Will set off at once towards the sound, and Lyra followed behind as he plunged down a narrow alley shadowed from the moonlight. After several twists and turns, they came out into the square in front of the stone tower they'd seen that morning. 20 or so children were facing inwards in a semicircle at the base of the tower, and some of them had sticks in their hands, and some were throwing stones at whatever they had trapped against the wall. At first Lyra thought it was another child, but coming from inside the semicircle was a horrible high wailing that wasn't human at all. And the children were screaming too, in fear as well as hatred. Will ran up to the children and pulled the first one back. It was a boy of about his own age, a boy in a striped T-shirt. As he turned, Lyra saw the wild white rims around his pupils, and then the other children realized what was happening and stopped to look. Angelica and her little brother were there too, stones in hand, and all the children's eyes glittered fiercely in the moonlight. They fell silent. Only the high wailing continued, and then both Will and Lyra saw what it was, a tabby cat cowering against the wall of the tower, its ear torn and its tail bent. It was the cat Will had seen in Sunderland Avenue, the one like Moxie, the one that had led him to the window. As soon as he saw her, he flung aside the boy he was holding. The boy fell to the ground and was up in a moment, furious, but the others held him back. Will was already kneeling by the cat, and then she was in his arms. She fled to his breast, and he cradled her close and stood to face the children, and Lyra thought for a crazy second that his demon had appeared at last.
"What are you hurting this cat for?"
he demanded, and they couldn't answer. They stood trembling at Will's anger, breathing heavily, clutching their sticks and their stones, and they couldn't speak. But then Angelica's voice came clearly.
"You ain't from here! You ain't from Jagat, so you didn't know about specters! You don't know about cats either! You ain't like us!"
The boy in the striped T-shirt whom Will had thrown down was trembling to fight, and if it hadn't been for the cat in Will's arms, he would have flown at Will with fists and teeth and feet, and Will would have gladly joined battle. There was a current of electric hatred between the two of them that only violence could ground, but the boy was afraid of the cat.
"Where you come from?"
"Doesn't matter where we come from. If you're scared of this cat, I'll take her away from you. If she's bad luck to you, she'll be good luck for us. Now get out of the way!"
For a moment, Will thought their hatred would overcome their fear, and he was preparing to put the cat down and fight. But then came a low, thunderous growl from behind the children, and they turned to see Lyra standing with her hand on the shoulders of a great spotted leopard, whose teeth shone white as he snarled. Even Will, who recognized Pantalaimon, was frightened for a second. Its effect on the children was dramatic. They turned and fled at once. A few seconds later, the square was empty. But before they left, Lyra looked up at the tower. A growl from Pantalaimon prompted her, and just briefly she saw someone there on the very top, looking down over the battlemented rim. And not a child either, but a young man with curly hair. Half an hour later they were in the flat above the cafe. Will had found a tin of condensed milk, and the cat had lapped it hungrily and then begun to lick her wounds. Pantalaimon had become cat-formed out of curiosity, and at first the tabby cat had bristled with suspicion, but she soon realized that whatever Pantalaimon was, he was neither a true cat nor a threat, and proceeded to ignore him. Lyra watched Will tending this one with fascination. The only animals she'd been close to in her world, apart from the armored bears, were working animals of one sort or another. Cats were for keeping Jordan College clear of mice, not for making pets of.
"Oh, I think her tail's broken. I don't know what to do about that. Maybe it'll heal by itself. I'll put some honey on her ear. I read about that somewhere. It's antiseptic."
It was messy, but at least it kept her occupied, licking it off, and the wound was getting cleaner all the time.
"You sure this is the one you saw?"
"Oh, yes. And if they're all so frightened of cats, there wouldn't be many in this world anyway. She probably couldn't find her way back."
"They were just crazy. They would have killed her. I've never seen kids being like that."
"I have."
But his face had closed. He didn't want to talk about it, and she knew better than to ask. She knew she wouldn't even ask the alethiometer. She was very tired, so presently she went to bed and slept at once. A little later, when the cat had curled up to sleep, Will took a cup of coffee and the green leather writing case and sat on the balcony. There was enough light coming through the window for him to read by, and he wanted to look at the papers. There weren't many. As he thought, they were letters written on airmail paper in black ink. These very marks were made by the hand of the man he wanted so much to find. He moved his fingers over and over them and pressed them to his face, trying to get closer to the essence of his father. Then he started to read.
"Fairbanks, Alaska. Wednesday, 19th of June, 1985. My darling, the usual mixture of efficiency and chaos. All the stores are here, but the physicist, a genial dimwit called Nelson, hasn't made any arrangement for carrying his damn balloons up into the mountains, having to twiddle our thumbs while he scrabbles around for transport. But it means I had a chance to talk to an old boy I met last time, a gold miner called Jake Peterson. Tracked him down to a dingy bar, and under the sound of the baseball game on the TV, I asked him about the anomaly. He wouldn't talk there, took me back to his apartment. With the help of a bottle of Jack Daniels, he talked for a long time. Hadn't seen it himself, but he'd met an Eskimo who had, and this chap said it was a doorway into the spirit world. They'd known about it for centuries. Part of the initiation of a medicine man involved going through and bringing back a trophy of some kind, though some never came back. However, old Jake did have a map of the area, and he'd marked on it where his pal had told him the thing was. Just in case, it's at 69 degrees, 2 minutes, 11 seconds north, 157 degrees, 12 minutes, 19 seconds west, on a spur of Lookout Ridge, a mile or two north of the Colville River. We then got on to other Arctic legends, the Norwegian ship that's been drifting unmanned for 60 years, stuff like that. The archaeologists are a decent crew, keen to get to work, containing their impatience with Nelson and his balloons. None of them has ever heard of the anomaly, and believe me, I'm going to keep it like that. My fondest love to you both. Johnny. Umiat, Alaska. Saturday, 22nd of June, 1985. My darling. So much for, what did I call him, a genial dimwit? The physicist Nelson is nothing of the sort, and if I'm not mistaken, he's actually looking for the anomaly himself. The hold-up in Fairbanks was orchestrated by him, would you believe? Knowing that the rest of the team wouldn't want to wait for anything less than an unarguable reason like no transport, he personally sent ahead and cancelled the vehicles that had been ordered. I found this out by accident, and I was going to ask him what the hell he was playing at, when I overheard him talking on the radio to someone, describing the anomaly, no less, except he didn't know the location. Later on, I brought him a drink, played the bluff soldier, old Arctic hand, more things in heaven and earth line. Pretended to tease him with the limitations of science, bet you can't explain Bigfoot, etc., watching him closely. Then sprung the anomaly on him. Eskimo legend of a doorway into spirit world. Invisible, somewhere near Lookout Ridge, would you believe, where we're heading for, fancy that. And you know he was jolted rigid. He knew exactly what I meant. I pretended not to notice and went on to witchcraft, told him the Zaire leopard story. So I hope he's got me down as a superstitious military blockhead. But I'm right, Elaine. He's looking for it too. The question is, do I tell him or not? Got to work out what his game is. Fondest love to both. Johnny. Colville Bar, Alaska. Monday, 24th of June, 1985. Darling, I won't get a chance to post another letter for a while. This is the last town before we take to the hills, the Brooks Range. The archaeologists are fizzing to get up there. One chap is convinced he'll find evidence of much earlier habitation than anyone suspected. I said, how much earlier, and why was he convinced? He told me of some narwhal ivory carvings he'd found on a previous dig, carbon-14 dated to some incredible age, way outside the range of what was previously assumed. Anomalous, in fact. Wouldn't it be strange if they'd come through my anomaly from some other world? Talking of which, the physicist Nelson is my closest buddy now, kids me along, drops hints to imply that he knows that I know that he knows, etc., and I pretend to be bluff Major Parry, stout fellow in a crisis, but not too much between the ears, what? But I know he's after it. For one thing, although he's a bona fide academic, his funding actually comes from the Ministry of Defence. I know the financial codes they use. And for another, his so-called weather balloons are nothing of the sort. I looked in the crate. A radiation suit, if ever I've seen one. A rum do, my darling. I shall stick to my plan. Take the archaeologists to their spot, and go off by myself for a few days to look for the anomaly. If I bump into Nelson wandering about on Lookout Ridge, I'll play it by ear. Later, a real bit of luck. I met Jake Peterson's pal, the Eskimo, Matt Kigalik. Jake had told me where to find him, but I hadn't dared to hope he'd be there. He told me the Soviets had been looking for the anomaly, too. He'd come across a man earlier this year, high up in the range, and watched him for a couple of days without being seen, because he guessed what he was doing, and he was right. And the man turned out to be Russian, a spy. He didn't tell me more than that, I got the impression he'd bumped him off, but he described the thing to me. It's like a gap in the air, a sort of window. You look through it, and you see another world. But it's not easy to find, because that part of the other world looks just like this, rocks and moss and so forth. It's on the north side of a small creek, 50 paces or so to the west of a tall rock shaped like a standing bear. And the position Jake gave me is not quite right. It's nearer 12 seconds north than 11. Wish me luck, my darling. I'll bring you back a trophy from the spirit world. I love you forever. Kiss the boy for me. Johnny.
Will found his head ringing. His father was describing exactly what he himself had found under the hornbeam trees. He, too, had found a window. He even used the same word for it. So Will must be on the right track. And this knowledge was what the men had been searching for. So it was dangerous, too. Will had been just a baby when that letter was written. 7 years after that had come the morning in the supermarket when he realized his mother was in terrible danger and he had to protect her. And then slowly in the months that followed came his growing realization that the danger was in her mind and he had to protect her all the more. And then, brutally, the revelation that not all the danger had been in her mind after all. There really was someone after her, after these letters, this information. He had no idea what it meant, but he felt deeply happy that he had something so important to share with his father. That John Parry and his son Will had each, separately, discovered this extraordinary thing. When they met, they could talk about it, and his father would be proud that Will had followed in his footsteps. The night was quiet and the sea was still. He folded the letters away and fell asleep. Chapter 6. Lighted Flyers.
"Grumman,"
said the black-bearded fur trader.
"From the Berlin Academy? Reckless. I met him 5 years back, over at the northern end of the Urals. I thought he was dead."
Sam Cansino, an old acquaintance and a Texan like Lee Scoresby, sat in the naphtha-laden, smoky bar of the Samirsky Hotel and tossed back a shot glass of bitingly cold vodka. He nudged the plate of pickled fish and black bread towards Lee, who took a mouthful and nodded for Sam to tell him more.
"He'd walked into a trap that fool Yakov Lev laid and cut his leg open to the bone. Instead of using regular medicines, he insisted on using the stuff the bears use, blood moss, some kind of lichen. It ain't a true moss. Anyway, he was lying on a sledge, alternately roaring with pain and calling out instructions to his men. They were taking star sights, and they had to get the measurements right, or he'd lash them with his tongue. And boy, he had a tongue like barbed wire. A lean man, tough, powerful, curious about everything. You know, he was a Tartar by initiation."
"You don't say,"
said Lee Scoresby, tipping more vodka into Sam's glass. His demon, Hester, crouched at his elbow on the bar, eyes half closed as usual, ears flat along her back. Lee had arrived that afternoon, borne to Nova Zembla by the wind the witches had called up, and once he'd stowed his equipment, he'd made straight for the Samirsky Hotel, near the fish-packing station. This was a place where many Arctic drifters stopped to exchange news or look for employment or leave messages for one another, and Lee Scoresby had spent several days there in the past, waiting for a contract or a passenger or a fair wind, so there was nothing unusual in his conduct now. And with the vast changes they sensed in the world around them, it was natural for people to gather and talk. With every day that passed came more news. The river Yenisei was free of ice, and at this time of year, too. Part of the ocean had drained away, exposing strange regular formations of stone on the seabed. A squid 100 feet long had snatched 3 fishermen out of their boat and torn them apart. And the fog continued to roll in from the north, dense and cold and occasionally drenched with the strangest imaginable light, in which great forms could be vaguely seen and mysterious voices heard. Altogether, it was a bad time to work, which was why the bar of the Samirsky Hotel was full.
"Did you say Grumman?"
said the man sitting just along the bar, an elderly man in seal hunter's rig, whose lemming demon looked out solemnly from his pocket.
He was a Tartar, all right. I was there when he joined that tribe. I saw him having his skull drilled. He had another name, too, a Tartar name. I'll think of it in a minute.
Well, how about that? Let me buy you a drink, my friend. I'm looking for news of this man. What tribe was it he joined?
The Yenisei Partas, at the foot of the Semyonov Range, near a fork of the Yenisei and the... I forget what it's called, a river that comes down from the hills. There's a rock the size of a house at the landing stage.
Sure, I remember it now. I've flown over it. And Grumman had his skull drilled, you say? Why was that?
He was a shaman. I think the tribe recognized him as a shaman before they adopted him. Some business, that drilling. It goes on for 2 nights of the day. They use a bow drill, like for lighting a fire.
That accounts for the way his team was obeying him. They were the roughest bunch of scoundrels I ever saw. But they ran around doing his bidding like nervous children. I thought it was his cursing that did it. If they thought he was a shaman, it'd make even more sense. But you know, that man's curiosity was as powerful as a wolf's jaws. He would not let go. He made me tell him every scrap I knew about the land thereabouts and the habits of wolverines and foxes. And he was in some pain from that damn trap of Yakovlev's, leg laid open. And he was writing the results of that blood moss, taking his temperature, watching the scar form, making notes on every damn thing. A strange man. There was a witch who wanted him for a lover, but he turned her down.
Is that so?
Said Lee, thinking of the beauty of Serafina Pekala.
He shouldn't have done that. A witch offers you her love, you should take it. If you don't, it's your own fault if bad things happen to you. It's like having to make a choice, a blessing or a curse. The one thing you can't do is choose neither.
He might have had a reason.
If he had any sense, it will have been a good one.
He was headstrong.
Maybe faithful to another woman. I heard something else about him. I heard he knew the whereabouts of some magic object, I don't know what it might be, that could protect anyone who held it. Did you ever hear that story?
Yes, I heard that. He didn't have it himself, but he knew where it was. There was a man who tried to make him tell, but Grumman killed him.
His demon, now that was curious. She was an eagle, a black eagle with a white head and breast, of a kind I'd never set eyes on. And I didn't know how she might be called.
She was an osprey,
said the barman, listening in.
You're talking about Stan Grumman? His demon was an osprey, a fish eagle.
What happened to him?
Oh, he got mixed up in the Skraeling Wars over at Bering Land. Last I heard, he'd been shot, killed outright.
I heard they beheaded him.
No, you're both wrong. And I know, because I heard it from an Inuit who was with him. Seems that they were camped out on Sakhalin somewhere, and there was an avalanche. Grumman was buried under 100 tons of rock. This Inuit saw it happen.
What I can't understand,
said Lee Scoresby, offering the bottle round,
is what the man was doing. Was he prospecting for rock oil, maybe? Or was he a military man? Or was it something philosophical? You said something about measurements, Sam. What would that be?
They were measuring the starlight and the aurora. He had a passion for the aurora. I think his main interest was in ruins, though. Ancient things.
I know who could tell you more. Up the mountain they have an observatory belonging to the Imperial Muscovite Academy. They'd be able to tell you. I know he went up there more than once.
What do you want to know for, anyway, Lee?
He owes me some money.
This explanation was so satisfying that it stopped their curiosity at once. The conversation turned to the topic on everyone's lips, the catastrophic changes taking place around them which no one could see.
The fishermen, they say you can sail right up into that new world.
There's a new world?
As soon as this damn fog clears, we'll see right into it. When it first happened, I was out in my kayak and looking north, just by chance. I'll never forget what I saw. Instead of the earth curving down over the horizon, it went straight on. I could see forever, And as far as I could see, there was land and shoreline, mountains, harbors, green trees and fields of corn, forever into the sky. I tell you, friends, that was something worth toiling 50 years to see. A sight like that. I would have paddled up the sky into that calm sea without a backward glance. But then came the fog.
Ain't never seen a fog like this. Reckon it set in for a month, maybe more. But you're out of luck if you want money from Stanislaus Grumman, Lee. The man's dead.
I got his Tartar name. I just remembered what they called him during the drilling. It sounded like Jopari.
Jopari? That's no kind of name I've ever heard of. Might be Nipponese, I suppose. Well, if I want my money, maybe I can chase up his heirs and assigns. Or maybe the Berlin Academy can square the debt. I'll go ask at the observatory, see if they have an address I can apply to.
The observatory was some distance to the north, and Lee Scoresby hired a dog sledge and driver. It wasn't easy to find someone willing to risk the journey in the fog, but Lee was persuasive, for his money was. And eventually an old Tartar from the Ob region agreed to take him there, after a lengthy bout of haggling. The driver didn't rely on a compass, or he would have found it impossible. He navigated by other signs, his Arctic fox demon for one, who sat at the front of the sledge keenly scenting the way. Lee, who carried his compass everywhere, had realized already that the Earth's magnetic field was as disturbed as everything else. The old driver said, as they stopped to brew coffee,
"This happened before, this thing."
"What, the sky opening? That happened before?"
"Many thousand generation. My people remember. All long time ago. Many thousand generation."
"What do they say about it?"
"Sky fall open, and spirits move between this world and that world. All the lands move. The ice melt, then freeze again. The spirits close up the hole after a while, seal it up. But witches say the sky is thin there behind the northern lights."
"What's going to happen, Umak?"
"Same thing as before. Make all same again. But only after big trouble. Big war. Spirit war."
The driver wouldn't tell him any more, and soon they moved on, tracking slowly over undulations and hollows and past outcrops of dim rock, dark through the pallid fog, until the old man said,
"Observatory, up there. You walk now. Path too crooked for sledge. You won't go back. I wait here."
"Yeah, I want to go back when I've finished, Umak. You make yourself a fire, my friend, and sit and rest a spell. I'll be 3-4 hours, maybe."
Lee Scoresby set off, with Hester tucked into the breast of his coat, and after half an hour's stiff climb found a clump of buildings suddenly above him, as if they'd just been placed there by a giant hand. But the effect was only due to a momentary lifting of the fog, and after a minute it closed in again. He saw the great dome of the main observatory, a smaller one a little way off, and between them a group of administration buildings and domestic quarters. No lights showed, because the windows were blacked out permanently so as not to spoil the darkness for their telescopes. A few minutes after he arrived, Lee was talking to a group of astronomers eager to learn what news he could bring them, for there are few natural philosophers as frustrated as astronomers in a fog. He told them about everything he'd seen, and once that topic had been thoroughly dealt with, he asked about Stanislaus Grumman. The astronomers hadn't had a visitor in weeks, and they were keen to talk.
"Grumman, yes, I'll tell you something about him,"
said the director.
"He was an Englishman, in spite of his name. I remember..."
"Surely not,"
said his deputy.
"He was a member of the Imperial German Academy. I met him in Berlin. I was sure he was German."
"No, I think you'll find he was English. His command of that language was immaculate anyway. But I agree, he was certainly a member of the Berlin Academy. He was a geologist."
"No, no, you're wrong,"
said someone else.
"He did look at the Earth, but not as a geologist. I had a long talk with him once. I suppose you'd call him a paleoarchaeologist."
They were sitting, five of them, around a table in the room that served as their common room, living and dining room, bar, recreation room, and more or less everything else. Two of them were Muscovites, one was a Pole, one a Yoruba, and one a Skraeling. Lee Scoresby sensed that the little community was glad to have a visitor, if only because he introduced a change of conversation. The Pole had been the last to speak, And then the Yoruba interrupted.
What do you mean a paleoarchaeologist? Archaeologists already study what's old. Why do you need to put another word meaning old in front of it?
His field of study went back much further than you'd expect, that's all. He was looking for remains of civilizations from 20,000-30,000 years ago.
The Pole replied.
Nonsense! Utter nonsense! The man was pulling your leg. Civilizations 30,000 years old. Ha! Where's the evidence?
Under the ice. That's the point. According to Grumman, the Earth's magnetic field changed dramatically at various times in the past, and the Earth's axis actually moved, too, so that temperate areas became icebound.
How?
Said one of the Muscovites.
Oh, he had some complex theory. The point was, any evidence there might have been for very early civilizations was long since buried under the ice. He claimed to have some photographs of unusual rock formations.
Is that all?
I'm only reporting, I'm not defending him.
How long had you known Grumman, gentlemen?
Well, let me see. It was 7 years ago I met him for the first time.
He made a name for himself a year or two before that, with his paper on the variations in the magnetic pole.
Said the Yoruba.
But he came out of nowhere. I mean, no one had known him as a student or seen any of his previous work.
They talked on for a while, contributing reminiscences and offering suggestions as to what might have become of Grumman, though most of them thought he was probably dead. While the Pole went to brew some more coffee, Lee's hair demon, Hester, said to him quietly,
"Check out the Skraeling, Lee."
The Skraeling had spoken very little. Lee had thought he was naturally taciturn, but prompted by Hester, he casually glanced across during the next break in the conversation to see the man's demon, a snowy owl, glaring at him with bright orange eyes. Well, that was what owls looked like, and they did stare. But Hester was right, and there was a hostility and suspicion in the demon that the man's face showed nothing of. And then Lee saw something else. The Skraeling was wearing a ring with the church's symbol engraved on it. Suddenly he realized the reason for the man's silence. Every philosophical research establishment, so he'd heard, had to include on its staff a representative of the magisterium, to act as a censor and suppress the news of any heretical discoveries. So realizing this, and remembering something he'd heard Lyra say, Lee asked,
"Tell me, gentlemen, do you happen to know if Grumman ever looked into the question of dust?"
And instantly a silence fell in the stuffy little room. Everyone's attention focused on the Skraeling, though no one looked at him directly. Lee knew that Hester would remain inscrutable, with her eyes half closed and her ears flat along her back, and he put on a cheerful innocence as he looked from face to face. Finally, he settled on the Skraeling and said,
"I beg your pardon. Have I asked about something it's forbidden to know?"
"Where did you hear mention of this subject, Mr. Scoresby?"
"From a passenger I flew across the sea a while back. They never said what it was, but from the way it was mentioned, it seemed like the kind of thing Dr. Grumman might have inquired into. I took it to be some kind of celestial thing, like the aurora. But it puzzled me, because as an aeronaut, I know the skies pretty well, and I'd never come across this stuff. What is it, anyhow?"
"As you say, a celestial phenomenon. It has no practical significance."
Presently, Lee decided it was time to leave. He had learned no more, and he didn't want to keep Umak waiting. He left the astronomers to their fog-bound observatory and set off down the track, feeling his way along by following his demon, whose eyes were closer to the ground. And when they were only 10 minutes down the path, something swept past his head in the fog and dived at Hester. It was the Skraeling's owl demon. But Hester sensed her coming and flattened herself in time, and the owl's claws just missed. Hester could fight. Her claws were sharp too, and she was tough and brave. Lee knew that the Skraeling himself must be close by, and reached for the revolver at his belt.
"Behind you, Lee,"
Hester said, and he whipped around, diving as an arrow hissed over his shoulder. He fired at once. The Skraeling fell, grunting as the bullet thudded into his leg. A moment later, the owl demon, wheeling on silent wings, swooped with a clumsy, fainting movement to his side and half lay on the snow, struggling to fold her wings. Lee Scoresby cocked his pistol and held it to the man's head.
"Right, you damn fool. What did you try that for? Can't you see we're all in the same trouble now this thing's happened to the sky?"
"It's too late."
"Too late for what?"
"Too late to stop. I have already sent a messenger bird. The magisterium will know of your inquiries, and they will be glad to know about Grumman."
"What about him?"
"The fact that others are looking for him. It confirms what we thought, and that others know of dust. You are an enemy of the church, Lee Scoresby. By their fruits shall ye know them. By their questions shall ye see the serpent gnawing at their heart.
The owl was making soft hooting noises and raising and dropping her wings fitfully. Her bright orange eyes were filming over with pain. There was a gathering red stain in the snow around the Skraeling. Even in the fog-thick dimness, Lee could see that the man was going to die.
Reckon my bullet must have hit an artery. Let go my sleeve and I'll make a tourniquet.
No, I am glad to die. I shall have the martyr's palm. You will not deprive me of that.
Then die if you want to. Just tell me this.
But he never had the chance to complete his question because with a bleak little shiver, the owl demon disappeared. The Skraeling's soul was gone. Lee had once seen a painting in which a saint of the church was shown being attacked by assassins. While they bludgeoned his dying body, the saint's demon was borne upward by cherubs and offered a spray of palm, the badge of a martyr. The Skraeling's face now bore the same expression as the saint's in the picture, an ecstatic straining towards oblivion. Lee dropped him in distaste. Hester clicked her tongue.
Should have reckoned he'd send a message. Take his ring.
What the hell for? We ain't thieves, are we?
No, we're renegades. Not by our choice, but by his malice. Once the church learns about this, we're done for anyway. Take every advantage we can in the meantime. Go on, take the ring and stow it away, and maybe we can use it.
Lee saw the sense and took the ring off the dead man's finger. Peering into the gloom, he saw that the path was edged by a steep drop into rocky darkness, and he rolled the Skraeling's body over. It fell for a long time before he heard any impact. Lee had never enjoyed violence, and he hated killing, although he'd had to do it 3 times before.
No sense in thinking that. He didn't give us a choice, and we didn't shoot to kill. Damn it, Lee, he wanted to die. These people are insane.
I guess you're right,
he said, and put the pistol away. At the foot of the path, they found the driver, with the dogs harnessed and ready to move.
Tell me, Umak,
Lee said as they set off back to the fish packing station.
You ever hear of a man called Grumman?
Oh, sure. Everybody know Dr. Grumman.
Did you know he had a Tartar name?
Not Tartar. You mean Jopari? Not Tartar.
What happened to him? Is he dead?
You ask me that, I have to say I don't know. So you'll never know the truth from me.
I see. So who can I ask?
You better ask his tribe. Better go to Yenisei. Ask them.
His tribe? You mean the people who initiated him? Who drilled his skull?
Yes. You better ask them. Maybe he not dead. Maybe he is. Maybe neither dead nor alive.
How can he be neither dead nor alive?
In spirit world. Maybe he in spirit world. Already I say too much. Say no more now.
And he did not. But when they returned to the station, Lee went at once to the docks and looked for a ship that could give him passage to the mouth of the Yenisei. Meanwhile, the witches were searching too. The Latvian queen, Ruta Skadi, flew with Serafina Pekala's company for many days and nights, through fog and whirlwind, over regions devastated by flood or landslide. It was certain that they were in a world none of them had known before, with strange winds, strange scents in the air, great unknown birds that attacked them on sight and had to be driven off with volleys of arrows. And when they found land to rest on, the very plants were strange. Still, some of those plants were edible, and they found rabbits that made a tasty meal, and there was no shortage of water. It might have been a good land to live in, but for the spectral forms that drifted like mist over the grasslands and congregated near streams and low-lying water. In some lights they were hardly there at all, just visible as a drifting quality in the light, a rhythmic evanescence, like veils of transparency turning before a mirror. The witches had never seen anything like them before, and mistrusted them at once.
Are they alive, do you think, Serafina Pekala?
Said Ruta Skadi as the witches circled high above a group of the things that stood motionless at the edge of a tract of forest.
Alive or dead, they're full of malice. I can feel that from here. And unless I knew what weapon could harm them, I wouldn't want to go closer than this.
The spectres seemed to be earthbound, without the power of flight, luckily for the witches. Later that day, they saw what the spectres could do. It happened at a river crossing, where a dusty road went over a low stone bridge beside a stand of trees. The late afternoon sun slanted across the grassland, drawing an intense green out of the ground and a dusty gold out of the air, and in that rich oblique light the witches saw a band of travellers making for the bridge, some on foot, some in horse-drawn carts, two of them riding horses. Serafina caught her breath. These people had no demons, and yet they seemed alive. She was about to fly down and look more closely when she heard a cry of alarm. It came from the rider on the leading horse. He was pointing at the trees, and as the witches looked down, they saw a stream of those spectral forms pouring across the grass, seeming to flow with no effort toward the people, their prey. The people scattered. Serafina was shocked to see the leading rider turn tail at once and gallop away, without staying to help his comrades, and the second rider did the same, escaping as fast as he could in another direction.
Fly lower and watch, sisters, but don't interfere until I command.
They saw that the little band contained children as well, some riding in the carts, some walking beside them. And it was clear that the children couldn't see the spectres, and the spectres weren't interested in them. They made instead for the adults. One old woman seated on a cart held two little children on her lap, and Rutaskadi was angered by her cowardice, because she tried to hide behind them and thrust them out towards the spectre that approached her, as if offering them up to save her own life. The children pulled free of the old woman and jumped down from the cart, and now, like the other children around them, ran to and fro in fright, or stood and clung together weeping as the spectres attacked the adults. The old woman in the cart was soon enveloped in a transparent shimmer that moved busily, working and feeding in some invisible way that made Rutaskadi sick to watch. The same fate befell every adult in the party apart from the two who had fled on their horses. Fascinated and stunned, Serafina Pekela flew down even closer. There was a father with his child who had tried to ford the river to get away, but a spectre had caught up with them, and as the child clung to the father's back, crying, the man slowed down and stood waist-deep in the water, arrested and helpless. What was happening to him? Serafina hovered above the water a few feet away, gazing, horrified. She had heard from travellers in her own world of the legend of the vampire, and she thought of that as she watched the spectre busy gorging on something, some quality the man had, his soul, his demon perhaps, for in this world evidently demons were inside, not outside. His arms slackened under the child's thighs, and the child fell into the water behind him and grabbed vainly at his hand, gasping, crying. But the man only turned his head slowly and looked down with perfect indifference at his little son, drowning beside him. That was too much for Serafina. She swooped lower and plucked the child from the water, and as she did so, Rutaskadi cried out,
"Be careful, sister! Behind you!"
And Serafina felt just for a moment a hideous dullness at the edge of her heart, and reached out and up for Rutaskadi's hand, which pulled her away from the danger. They flew higher, the child screaming and clinging to her waist with sharp fingers, and Serafina saw the spectre behind her, a drift of mist swirling on the water, casting about for its lost prey. Rutaskadi shot an arrow into the heart of it with no effect at all.